From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. The manhunt continues today for 29-year-old Travis Reinking, who's suspected of killing four people at a Waffle House restaurant outside of Nashville early Sunday morning. Wearing nothing but a green jacket, Reinking opened fire with an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle. He's believed to have run home naked to put on pants before disappearing. Officials say he remains at large and may be armed and dangerous. Tony Gonzalez is a reporter for Nashville Public Radio. He joins us now. And Tony, what's the latest? What are police saying? Any closer to finding Reinking?
Well, no, not necessarily closer to finding him. There's not been a credible sighting for more than a day. And the search really yesterday was carried out through pouring rain, just hours and hours of rain. There are dozens of officers and federal agents that are on the hunt. There are helicopters up, search dogs. Police have been going door to door, you know, making sure that people are safe, that, he's not hiding out somewhere. Police are really concerned because when they swept through Ryan King's apartment, they couldn't find a handgun and a rifle that he was known to have.
So door-to-door searches, you're speaking to us from Nashville, where schools are taking extra precautions today. Tell us about that and the mood there. People must be on edge.
Yeah, honestly, in that area, I think people are. You know, so the schools are open. Police swept through them yesterday, and now they're on what's called lockout, just meaning no visitors today. But other sort of small occurrences, I think, are kind of taking on, you know, more meaning. Just one example, like on social media, there was a home break-in last night nearby during a power outage, totally unrelated, but people are just, you know, worrying more than normal while this manhunt is still going on. I should say, you know, there's also the victims. You know, one was a local rapper, another a college senior. So it's kind of rippling through different parts of the community, and all the victims were really young. They were all under age 30.
The shooting occurred just before 3:30 a.m. on Sunday, and police say the killing could have been a lot worse. It was cut short after a customer, James Shaw Jr., wrestled the gun away from the shooter. Here's Shaw speaking with reporters yesterday.
I'm just a regular person, and I think anybody could have did what I did if they're just pushed in that kind of cage. And you have to either react or you have to, or you're going to, you know, fold. And I chose to react because I didn't see any other way of me, you know, living. And that's all I wanted to do.
Tony, a harrowing experience for sure for James Shaw Jr. What more did he say about that moment?
Yeah, you know, he spoke about it with his hand bandaged up, speaking to reporters. He remembers the moment, you know, really vividly. First he heard the sound of plates crashing, then the windows burst. He saw that somebody had been shot. He briefly was hiding behind a door, and he thinks he was grazed by a bullet. Eventually, he rushed forward to the gunman. There was a struggle over the gun. In fact, Shaw said he grabbed the barrel of it and that it was hot and I guess sort of burned him. But he got the gun away, threw it over the counter. He eventually ended up outside with the gunman and saw him trotting away. I mean, quite a moment. Police definitely say he's a hero who saved many lives. Shaw also said that he has a daughter, and that it sort of all really hit home for him when he was, you know, thinking about her in the back of the ambulance.
And Shaw reacted when the shooter was reloading, or may have run out of bullets, or what?
Yeah, they're not totally clear if it was a jam or a reload moment, but yeah, Shaw said he sort of saw that the shooting had stopped and acted in that moment.
Tony, the shooter, Travis Reinking, was arrested 9 months ago outside the White House. Tell us about that arrest and the fallout.
In July, he was detained by the Secret Service outside of the White House. I guess he was asking for a meeting with the president. He was near some bike racks, but then I guess stepped across a barrier where the Secret Service then would take action. That ultimately led to his firearm license out of Illinois being revoked and four guns being confiscated from Reinking.
And he got those weapons back. Tell us how he had got those back.
Yeah, this has been a big question, and a lot of law enforcement agencies are talking about this. So his four guns were taken and given to his father, who promised to keep them away, but eventually returned them to his son. That's according to the police. And they do know exactly which guns they were, and they do match at least this the AR-15 rifle that was used in this shooting. So he did get those guns back.
Tony, what, if anything, are police saying about Reinking's mental state and a possible motive?
They've not shared a motive, but they are worried about his mental health. You know, the Associated Press, for example, reported several other run-ins with local police back in Illinois, including Ryan King reporting that he was being stalked. And at some point, he did agree to an evaluation. We know that Ryan King had only recently moved to Nashville from specifically Morton, Illinois. He lived alone here, briefly had a job in construction. He was fired. Police say he got another similar job, but then didn't even show up last week on his second day of work. We're not sure, you know, how that's related. Police also noted they didn't find any kind of writings or any kind of note. So, and apparently he didn't say anything during the shooting. So we don't know.
We'll be watching the case. The shooter's still on the run in Tennessee. Tony Gonzalez is a reporter for Nashville Public Radio. Tony, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, since the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, gun control has roared back as a political issue ahead of November's midterm elections. It's even percolating in some of the rural congressional districts where President Trump is popular. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports from northern New York.
When Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik held town hall meetings here in New York's 21st district earlier this month, she kept hearing this from constituents like Marianne Johnson.
Guns are a very important part of our culture up here for hunting, for sport, for self-protection. But assault weapons are a very different kind of animal.
Johnson spoke in the fire hall in tiny Moriah, New York. And she's right. This is a place where guns and hunting are a way of life. But Johnson says a lot of her neighbors think some types of guns should be banned.
It could happen right here to this group of people. It could happen at a school concert, the movie theater, the mall. What can we do about the assault weapons to get them from harming people?
Incumbent Stefanik's sprawling district stretches from the outskirts of Albany to the U.S.-Canada border. She has an A rating from the NRA. At this session, most of the people who spoke said they favor additional gun regulation, including a ban on assault-style weapons. Still, Stefanik told them she opposes the idea.
There are many gun owners who are law-abiding citizens, thousands in this district, that own semi-automatic weapons, and they use them for recreation, they use them for sport, they use them in some cases for hunting.
But these days, voters aren't letting the issue go. At meeting after meeting, guns come up and people push back against the idea that the Second Amendment should cover all firearms, including weapons with military features like high-capacity magazines.
I believe in our Second Amendment rights, and I think that we need to...
Despite the shift on guns by some of her constituents, Stefanik isn't budging. In fact, she voted recently to expand the rights of people who carry concealed weapons. But on the Democratic side of this House race, there is a big shift underway.
Yeah, this is the only issue on the campaign that I have actually substantially changed my position on.
Patrick Nelson is one of seven Democrats running in the primary here, hoping to unseat Stefanik. He says he, too, used to oppose a national ban on assault-style weapons, but that changed after Parkland.
I favor bringing back the assault weapons ban, and I've spoken with a lot of gun owners around the North Country, around the 21st District, that seem to feel the same way.
Until recently, it was normal in upstate New York for Democrats to seek the NRA's endorsement. The last Democrat elected to this district's House seat, he won the NRA's highest approval rating. But at a political forum in the district right after the Parkland shooting, the crowd pushed Democratic candidates to support gun control and oppose the NRA's ideas about school safety.
I'm a retired teacher. The last thing we need in schools are guns. Teachers don't want them.
Democratic candidates like Donald Boyajian responded by pivoting hard against the NRA.
They have a chokehold on Congress. You know what the NRA really stands for? Not relevant anymore. We need their influence out of Congress right now.
Conventional wisdom holds that gun control is a losing issue for Democrats, especially in competitive districts like this one that tilt rural and conservative. But some gun rights advocates say they worry support for their cause may be slipping, even here.
The NRA is an easy victim. I don't know why, because we advocate the Second Amendment.
Bernard Beebe is a farmer who came to a town hall meeting wearing an NRA ball cap. He points out that New York State already has tough gun laws, which he thinks violate his constitutional rights. In recent weeks, neighboring Vermont also tightened its gun laws dramatically.
Do you think legislation will come? Yes, because there's too many liberals that don't understand the Second Amendment.
So things have changed. For a long time, the idea that guns are a fixture here, a cornerstone of small-town life, that went pretty much unquestioned and unchallenged. Not anymore. Not after Parkland. The election in November will be a test of how far that political and cultural shift has gone. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Mann in Northern New York.
Spring break with your kids?
That was great.
Thank you. Welcome to the classroom. Would you like to answer the question sheet?
The classroom is in the absolutely delightful New York Historical Society Museum off Central Park on Manhattan's Upper West Side. The students are immigrants, all green card holders, some with their kids, some of the 650 immigrants who've taken part in the museum's citizenship project, which uses the art and objects of the museum to help teach American principles and, in so doing, help the immigrants pass their citizenship tests. Today, teacher Jennifer Young leads the group to a painting of the British ocean liner, the Lusitania.
The citation says, "Remember the Lusitania." What's the Lusitania?
The Lusitania was a ship that went down near the Britain coast by German submarines.
Okay. Great. Okay, so let's start.
Jennifer explains there were many Americans on board, and anger at their deaths put pressure on President Wilson to enter World War I.
My name is Ahmad Gohari, and I'm from Iran. I wanted to know more about the history of the United States, and also I want to pass the citizenship exam. It's a good opportunity for us to see some arts that are related to the history.
They walk through halls filled with paintings and artifacts. Here's a room devoted to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, whose ancestors came on the Mayflower, but famously said, "All of us are descended from immigrants." The class looks at a glass-encased brace, the one he wore because of the polio he kept from the public.
Yeah, I'm here.
Was this real leather or was it plastic?
It's real leather. Yeah, I mean, well, let's look at it. You want to look closer at the label? How does that make you feel when you look at it?
Vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why he would have most understanding of the people.
So he had an understanding of people because...
make it more connected to us.
Ah, that's a really good point. Okay, so we're going to go back down.
That last student, Adriana Singamim, originally from Guatemala, is stunned to learn that FDR wore a brace.
Today, the brace that Franklin Roosevelt used, which I didn't have no idea, and he's such a magnificent president during those years. Actually, if you can say to everyone, thank you for such a wonderful opportunity, the art is beyond explanation. Thank you so much.
The thanks should go to the program's creators, including historian Samantha Rikers, herself a green card holder from the Netherlands.
You designed this program. What do you have to think about?
Well, people who want to become American citizens, they have to study 100 questions about American history and government and geography. And I just started by looking at those questions and thinking, what do we have in our collections that we can use to connect students to those questions?
And by the way, we're going to ask our listeners, too, some of those questions to see if they know the answers. But what were some of those things you had to think of?
So one of the questions is, who was the first president? And then we can use artwork of George Washington actually becoming the first president. We have a painting. It's called Washington Taking the Oath.
Were there some questions where you just, how do we find a piece that goes with this?
One question is, what is the rule of law? We have a print in our collections that shows an image of the Boston Massacre. John Adams actually represented the British soldiers. And he argued that that was important because if we are not a nation of laws, chaos will ensue.
He represented the British soldiers that massacred the Bostonians.
He did. And he said we should be a country of laws, not men. And that's how we connect it to the question, what is the rule of law?
New York Historical Society Chief Operating Officer Jennifer Shantz came up with the idea of the Citizenship Project shortly after President Trump proposed his travel ban. The Supreme Court takes up the question of whether the president can legally restrict entry into the U.S. this week.
It's a very insecure time for immigrants in this nation, and the only way really to become more secure is to become a citizen. If you're not a citizen, you can't travel abroad easily, you can't vote. We've decided to do what we do best, which is teach American history to the immigrant community, to green card holders, so that they can be more secure here.
Was it to counter the ban?
Well, I think we are a nation of immigrants. In fact, Alexander Hamilton was an immigrant.
I would think that in particular, being at the New York Historical Society, you see every time you walk through the halls here stories of other immigrant populations that were denied access. People are surprised to hear that for a time, Italians and Polish people, you're nodding, were denied access to the U.S. because it was thought that they would not be smart enough to integrate.
We had an exhibition on the Chinese Exclusion Act. We had an exhibition on first Jewish Americans. We also had an exhibition on Nueva York. We had Spanish Americans here in the early 1600s. And they're just as American as, Europeans.
I'm sure that there are hurdles to overcome. I mean, what are some of the things that you've heard along the way, Samantha?
Well, one of the first questions that we ask is, what is one thing that surprised you when you first came to the United States? And the responses to that are really amazing. I said for me, I was so surprised to see people carrying drinks around. It's something that I was not used to in Europe. And we drink our coffee, we sit down and we drink our coffee. We don't have to-go cups. And for some students, it was snow. Even those little things, I think, really makes everyone realize that we're all in this together in a way.
Today, Samantha is using Johannes Oertel's painting, Pulling Down the Statue of King George III in New York City. It depicts the real event, an excited crowd pulling down the statue after the Declaration of Independence was adopted. But on the perimeter, the artist adds nervous Native Americans and blacks. With Samantha is Christian Colton, a British actor who's lived in New York for 10 years, but wants to become a citizen to vote and become more involved. Samantha asks him a question.
What comments would you say the artist is making on the role of Native Americans in the new nation?
Well, they're certainly not being included in the decisions that are being made. They're watching from the sidelines.
And also in the shadows. They're in much darker colors.
I'm going to interrupt for a second. Christian, I'm thinking this must be powerful given that this is the moment that your home country lost a war. Do you not see it that way?
I guess I don't. I think of myself as being someone who is here rather than there.
So this is really fascinating to me because people from different countries really respond differently. If you talk about pulling down statues, people talk about the debates over Confederate statues.
And what questions might this relate to?
So actually several questions. One of the questions on the test is when was the Declaration of Independence adopted? July 4, 1776. Also, why did the colonists fight the British? Why are they pulling down the statue? And talk about taxes.
I was just thinking, well, you know, the U.S. and Britain have a shared history. Fought a revolution. Are you surprised at what you didn't know?
Yeah, well, my experience of the way I was taught history is we get taught the bits where England was doing really well. So it tends to be the Renaissance, the First World War, the Second World War, and that's about it. In terms of the American Revolution, that never came up in class.
No. The Tea Party?
That part all gets skipped.
None of that?
I think I mostly learned that once I had moved here.
It was interesting that Christian said that in the Netherlands, we rarely talk about that this was even part of the Netherlands.
Your people, my people, this was their city.
Yes, but...
And then we lost it. You didn't know that?
I knew, but it's more a footnote, so I knew very little. So, what do you see?
It's wooden with a crank handle. It looks a little bit like something you would pull bingo numbers out of. Mm-hmm. Draft wheel used July 13th, 1863. The draft is when people are...
They've now moved to a wooden barrel that held draft numbers during the Civil War.
So in 1863, the Civil War became very unpopular. Many people did not support the war. Many people saw photographs of what had happened and that people were dying. And they said, we're not excited about this. And if you think about those men, many of them were immigrants. Many of them were Irish immigrants. And many of those Irish immigrants were being told by politicians, if the Union wins the war, slavery will end in the South, and all these people who were formerly enslaved are going to come up here to New York City, and they're going to take your jobs. So for many Irish immigrants, they say, what do we have to gain? We're either going to die in this war, or if we win, we're going to lose our jobs. So in the summer of 1863, riots broke out.
The question on the test is simply, what do we call the war between the North and the South? Christian, when do you find out, by the way?
I've done my biometrics and now I'm waiting. I'm in line for an interview.
And how are you feeling about that?
Excited, nervous.
Do you feel prepared? I'm looking at this barrel and I'm thinking, I would have come here, I would have seen that barrel and I would have thought, well, that's interesting, there was a draft. I never would have known this huge history that's behind it that you now know. Are you feeling prepared?
Yes, I feel very prepared, actually.
You could have memorized all 100 questions and answers, and you would have been fine.
Sure, sure. But not only did this help keep them, but also, for me, there was something very powerful about sitting in a room with other immigrants from very different backgrounds and ages and places, and all pooling experience and learning together, and to feel like part of a group of people choosing to naturalize here, moving to a different country and then staying there, and how powerful and strange that is. I actually have a ton of friends who immediately were like, how do we take this class? But they're already citizens, so they don't get to.
Christian Colson, a Brit hoping to become an American citizen through the New York Historical Society's Citizenship Project. So how do you think you do on the test, Eric? Let me ask you.
Here's a pop quiz?
Yeah. Under our Constitution, some powers belong to the federal government. One power of the federal government. Name one.
I need more coffee, but declare war, Robert.
Declare war, print money, a couple more. 13 original states. Name three.
Live free or die, New Hampshire, New York, New Jersey.
Okay, you got them. Name one war fought by the U.S. in the 1800s.
War of 1812. Come
yeah.
on.
More here now, though.
It's a tough time for big American toy makers. Shares in Hasbro were down nearly 3% this morning after the company reported a sharp drop in revenue. Overall sales also fell around 16% in the first quarter. Hasbro's CEO Brian Goldner blamed the sour numbers on a different company, Toys R Us. Toys R Us is going out of business and closing all of its U.S. stores, stores that sold a lot of Hasbro products. And Charisse Jones of USA Today joins us to sort it all out. Hi, Charisse.
Hello.
Hasbro is the largest toy maker in the world. Toys R Us was one of that company's biggest customers. I mean, how's Hasbro going to sell its toys without Toys R Us?
They're probably going to have to turn to a lot of other retailers that were already peeling off a lot of Toys R Us's business, like Target and Walmart, Amazon, the online giant. And you have a lot of new players moving into the toy space, like JCPenney's and Kohl's are actually selling toys now. Even Party City, the party supply store, is starting to add to that merchandise in their stores. And so those are probably the outlets they're going to have to turn to fill that void.
Is there a bigger issue here? I mean, is part of the issue that, you know, kids aren't really playing with some of the toys Hasbro makes? Monopoly, G.I. Joe, My Little Pony, Transformers. I mean, they were popular, but maybe not as popular now.
Yeah, this is the electronics generation, right? They're on their smartphones playing with video games. They love their gadgets. And some of those lines like Transformers and My Little Pony are getting a little stagnant, a little long in the tooth. They've been around a while and they're not as exciting to kids. And so that's definitely been a big problem for a lot of toy makers.
We're also getting earnings from Mattel later this week, another big toy maker. But you report that smaller toy makers are actually being hit hardest by the Toys R Us liquidation and bankruptcy. How so?
You know, Toys R Us was this incredible showroom, and they had all of the space. They had this year-round focus. And unlike some of these other retailers that just stocked up at Christmas time, they're selling toys year-round. So for a lot of smaller toy makers, this was their chance, right? They could get shelf space at Toys R Us and really get off the ground. And without them around, the places that they can kind of go and get their start are greatly diminished.
Interesting. How's Hasbro doing outside the U.S. where this Toys R Us bankruptcy isn't really an issue?
You know, they're doing very well in Asia and Latin America because, like you said, Toys R Us is really not a presence there. Struggling a little bit in Europe where they are, and they've had some of the same problems. So they're probably going to have to focus a little bit more on some of these overseas areas as they try to get off the ground and get back a foot in the United States with the Toys R Us brand kind of going away.
And Charisse, before you go, update us on this bankruptcy. Where are we in that process? Are stores still open or are they all closed? Where are we?
They're still open, but they've been liquidating the merchandise since March, and it's not looking good. There was a big toy maker, the person that was behind the Bratz brand, that was trying to salvage some of the stores, but it's looking like the 735 Toys R Us stores that we've grown up with are going to go away. And it's pretty sad for a lot of kids.
Indeed. Charisse Jones of USA Today, thank you.
Thank you.
Now he's a U.S. Marshal and a Lone Ranger. He is a U.S. Marshal and a Lone Ranger.
Black Cowboys is the new album from Dom Flemons, co-founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drops. It's a tribute to the often overlooked music, culture, and history of the Black Cowboys. The album's on Smithsonian Folkways, and Dom Flemons joins us from NPR in Washington to talk about it. Dom Flemons, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
There were thousands of Black cowboys, but that's often been left out of the narrative of the American West. From dime store novels to old Hollywood Westerns, there's a romanticized, sometimes racist view of that history. Talk about the role Black cowboys played in the country's westward expansion.
Well, during that period, you have a really unique experience that happened in the African-American community, because this is halfway between where the end of slavery happened, emancipation was gained, and then also there was the Reconstruction era in the South. And you had this movement of African-American people going out west to try to find independent wages outside of the old system of sharecropping, which retained many aspects of slave work. And with that, you start finding that all these unique cultures start to bloom. And in the African-American community, you have places like Oklahoma, which has a lot of all-black towns that sprung up between the 1870s to the 1920s.
Let's listen to another tune off the album. This is Black Woman.
Come here, black woman. And sit on daddy's knee. Well, I've got something to tell you, pretty mama.
Dom, how do these songs shed light on this sometimes marginalized history?
Well, you know, that first track, for example, Black Woman, sheds a little bit of light on the strength and the power of the women of the West. Just like the African-American cowboys, there were African-American women, and then, of course, women of all sorts of ethnicities that were out West. And one of the first books I read on black cowboys was a book about a black cowboy named Bones Hooks, and he was from the panhandle of Texas. And one of the things that he tried to do in his last years, I guess that was in the 1940s, he wrote a letter to the Pioneer Society that he was a part of, and he wanted to erect a statue to the frontier women. And the reason that he wrote in his letter was that the men had built Boot Hill and Tuscoa Hill and all of the saloons and the rough and rowdy places of the West. But it wasn't until the women came and settled in the West that you started seeing churches and schools and some of the finer things in life that you can really build a society and a civilization. That's when you really start seeing the development.
You introduce us to a lot of characters. Here's a song called Steel Pony Blues. Let's take a listen.
You get down to Holbrook, you won't find me there. Good Lord, I got the first thing smoking down the road somewhere. Got the first thing smoking down the road somewhere. Well, I called my steel pony and boys, I'm gonna ride. Getting far too old to follow this here herd. Good Lord, I caught the first thing smoking down the road somewhere. Called the first thing smoking down the road somewhere. I called my steel pony and boys, I'm going to ride.
This is about Nat Love, known as Deadwood Dick. Who was he?
He was a black cowboy who was born in Tennessee, and then after emancipation, he moved out west, and he worked in Arizona as a cowboy for a long time in a town called Holbrook, Arizona. And later on, he began to work at the Denver and Rio Grande Western Railroad line as a Pullman porter. And I started finding that that was a trend as a lot of the cowboy work went away. Many of the African-American cowboys became Pullman porters on the train lines. And that was something that I thought was a very unique experience, just because the history of Pullman porters and how they linked to the later civil rights movement in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, I thought that that was a very unique connection to make, where you can think of these black cowboys as having gone through all of the different cattle trails and learning the entire United States continent, and then being able to translate that into their work on the railroad lines.
Left me, baby, 1 year ago, but I still love you. I'm moaning low, Lord, I'm blue and so down, honey. That lonesome old river's my home. I bought you diamonds.
It's long been said that cowboy singing was an answer to a lot of lonely nights traveling, sometimes without family. Is there a connection, you think, to the blues tradition in these songs?
Absolutely. The black cowboys, they brought those elements that we would now think of as the blues, and they brought them to cowboy music, and that was something that slowly developed over a long period of time, because of course, when we think of being out on the range, they didn't have radios or anything, so you just had to make songs up as part of the community, and they would expand, and then they would travel if they were liked well enough. I can't help but see those comparisons to how we now would describe the blues.
Little Joe the Wrangler speaks to some of that that you're just talking about.
Little Joe the Wrangler will never wrangle more. His days with the Remuda, they are done. 'Twas a year ago last April he joined the outfit here. A little Texas stray and all alone.
It's a story of a young boy who leaves home because his stepmother starts beating him. And he goes out on the range and tries to join the cowboys out there. And there's a stampede that happens. And he ultimately tries to be a hero. And he dies doing it.
Dom, not all these songs on here are traditional. You wrote some of them. Let's take a listen to $1 Bill.
$1 Bill, $2 Bill, ain't no bill like a railroad bill. Take away that makeup, child, no, it ain't none of mine. If you keep wearing them false eyelashes, gal, you're gonna go stone blind with that railroad bill. $1
What was the inspiration behind that song?
Well, that song, I really wanted to approach the idea of Hollywood cowboys and the African-American Hollywood cowboy and just have a song that was just a real dramatic, cliffhanger type song where there was action and adventure, there was gunplay, there was a woman that had done a guy wrong, and just a lot of the elements that tend to that have won the American heart and imagination for more than a century. And, you know, I wanted to try to really make it rooted in traditional music and feature aspects of the music like the East Texas blues songsters, for example, like people like Lightning Hopkins and Mance Lipscomb, Lead Belly, Henry Ragtime, Texas Thomas. Those are all musicians that have pieces of the cowboy culture within their repertoires, and so I wanted to bring that into focus in addition to the stories that I had read about, so that there was you could get a good sense of musically where many of these cowboys in the early days were, because of course after the trail rides ended and after the African-American cowboys were gone, the image of the cowboy was redefined as a white person, and it was about the struggle of a a white savior. Mm-hmm. And that's good and fine in of itself, but it's left a skewed perception of how we think about who was out there on the range and how diverse it was in the actual old days.
Well, we're going to go out on Texas Easy Street, Dom Flemons. His new album is Black Cowboys. It's on Smithsonian Folkways. Dom, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, Eric. It's just been a pleasure to speak with you.
Hey, what the matter now? Please tell me, Mama, what's the matter now?
You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm going back to Texas, live on Easy Street.
Netflix, the company that pioneered online movie streaming, putting a dent in the brick-and-mortar theater business, is now considering buying up those brick-and-mortar cinemas, according to the LA Times. And Disney, the company with some of the biggest box office hits, is getting into streaming. What's going on? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does every Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
And start with Netflix. The company declined to comment to the LA Times. But if they are buying movie theaters, why? Movie theaters hate Netflix because they cut into the movie business.
That's right. They do. Indeed, Netflix trying to buy movie theaters, it feels a little bit like Amazon opening brick-and-mortar bookstores, like the disruptor getting directly back into the industry that it's helped to disrupt. I can see two possible reasons for why Netflix would want to buy movie theaters. The first is that this is just all about awards and marketing. Netflix recently pulled out of the Cannes Film Festival in France because movies there without theatrical distribution, that means movies that were not released in movie theaters, they were banned from competing for prizes. So maybe this is Netflix's way of getting back into those prestigious cultural events, making sure that its films are recognized on par with other film studios. So maybe it's about awards, number one. But number two, maybe this is about economics. Maybe Netflix wants to be more like Disney. It wants to show that it can create cultural tentpole events. It wants to maybe supplement some of its streaming revenue with box office ticket revenue, which it would get if it owned some movie theaters and could prove that, yes, people who have Netflix could always watch some movies at home, but maybe they want to come into movie theaters and experience them in a group the way that movies are at Cineplex.
Are supposed to be experienced. That's just me.
Perhaps, yes, indeed.
Oh, well, and you mentioned Disney. So Disney, and by the way, another speculation is that Netflix might be wanting to do this because they might get these better, bigger filmmakers who want to see their films on the big screen. But now you have Disney saying, you know, where they're going to go the other way, potentially, at least the LA Times says this, and start streaming. What's going on there?
Well, let me connect it to Amazon one more time, not because everything has to be about Amazon, but it's sometimes said in retail that Amazon is trying to become Walmart faster than Walmart can become Amazon. Well, that's exactly what's happening in the entertainment world. Netflix wants to become Disney faster than Disney can become Netflix. Mm. Netflix wants to become, as you said, a force to be reckoned with in theaters, a destination that is considered on par with Time Warner and Warner Brothers and Disney. But at the same time, Disney's out there seeing its pay TV product, its cable bundle, sort of slowly eroding. It's seeing that movie tickets bought per year reached an all-time low on a per capita basis in 2017. It wants to get into streaming. It sees the future of entertainment as reaching consumers where they are, and increasingly where they are is stuck in their living rooms and bedrooms streaming all the livelong day.
Well, yeah, so people are really watching. It's just that they're watching less at the movie theaters, but watching a heck of a lot more on their devices.
That's right. That's right. And I think Disney is essentially saying, look, if this is where our consumers are, we have to meet them where they are. We need to create a Disney Flix, a streaming-only product where if you open up that little tab on your computer or on your television screen, imagine being able to see everything Disney owns, all those animated films, every Star Wars movie, every Indiana Jones movie, every Pixar and Marvel film. I mean, it really could be an unbelievably competitive product that I think could transform the entertainment business. Yeah. That if Disney gets Disney Flix right, then that alone could mean that the future of entertainment as we understand it will have changed.
And by the way, it's Netflix that the LA Times is reporting wants to buy at movie theaters. They haven't confirmed it. But Disney is definitely going with this streaming. But what about, I mean,
what about the future? Because aren't there still going to be people who want to go sit in a movie theater? It's a communal event, wear the costumes of the characters that are on the screen. Do you see, if Disney leaves, or at least goes into streaming in a big way, can movie theaters survive?
Yeah, so two things really quickly. First, I do think that Disney is going to find that a good way to get a lot of people to sign up for this streaming service is to make their films subscription only. So imagine something like Black Panther becoming subscription only. You had to subscribe to Disney Flix in order to watch it. And I do think that this could really, really hurt the movie theater industry. It would basically be Disney gobbling up all those tickets for itself on streaming. But I do think that there is a general understanding that the movie theater business has essentially been in a slow motion decline since the 1950s, like basically since the Dwight Eisenhower administration. Movie theater tickets bought per capita have been in decline. So I don't think that movie theaters are ever going to go away entirely, but a company like Disney, trying to build for the next 20 years, 40 years of its business, has to look seriously at the possibility of putting its chips on streaming, and that means taking away its chips from the movie theater business.
Boy, I just hope that there's always a time when you can go have a communal experience, cry, laugh with an audience in a movie theater. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. I know that makes me so old school, doesn't
it? There'll always be opera.
That's right. Thanks, Derek.
You got it.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.